From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in Marysville, Ohio. That's where the Honda Accord is largely produced domestically. I say largely because some parts may come from other places, but the assembly happens in Marysville, Ohio. The Honda Civic is assembled in East Liberty, Ohio, which raises an interesting question. Does that make the Honda Civic and the Honda Accord American products? How much of a car has to be produced in the United States for it to become an American car? What if it's just assembled here, but is foreign-owned? Now, here's why this matters. In the world of global supply chains, it's easy to get confused about what is and what is not an American product or a Canadian product or whatever. And when trade deals are coming together, someone has to draw a line and then police it. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, that's the word, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, otherwise known as the TPP, is another trade deal inspiring similar questions. And certainly we don't have all the answers about TPP, but when you look at NAFTA and other deals, how are these things constructed? How do they come together? Who's involved? How are they policed? Let's talk about some of that with Rob Shum. He's a professor of political science and international studies at the SUNY College at Brockport. He also happens to have been a Canadian representative on the NAFTA Committee on Trade in Goods. Rob, welcome back to the program.
Nice to be here, Evan.
And Dr. Jungho Choi is here, an assistant professor in the School of Business at St. John Fisher College. Dr. Choi, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for your invitation.
All right, Rob, I'm going to start with you because I dragged you here after I saw a conversation you were having on Twitter, and I said, this is fascinating. And Rob tried to tell me it's not that fascinating. I said, look, this is the broccoli of the discussion world, but it's important. These are the kind of things that we need to try to understand if we're looking at trade deals. So why don't you start by telling us what you did as a Canadian representative on the NAFTA deal? What was it?
Well, it's one of these things that people don't think about. I think one of the problems in discussions of trade policy is that in general, there used to be ads run in the 80s. Again, when the last time there was talk about trade wars, there were, ads talking about faceless bureaucrats. And, conspiracy theories and all sorts of extreme ideas about how trade deals get put together do sort of arise. But it's just ordinary nerdy guys like me. I used to work in the government. And one of the reasons why, as government bureaucrats, you don't have an incentive to come out and explain things. People spend most of their time, or their lifetime, their careers in government. I happen to have taken a different path. I love, obviously I'm here in Rochester now and teaching, and that's what I love to do. So I'm able to maybe put a little bit of perspective there. But what I did, for example, NAFTA, people think that after it was negotiated, it was over and done with, but we have to keep, changing and adjusting the rules about things like the accord, about defining, what products qualify and don't qualify. And we can, and if the listeners want to understand how exactly these deals are put together and maybe think about, whether it's credible or not, some of these effects for things like TPP, they're overstated, I think, on both sides. Because if you think about how it's put together, how people like me in government, all we're doing really is we take complaints all the time. We just people running businesses want to be able to sell their stuff to other countries. And they come in and say, change the rules to make it easier for us. And that's all we're doing, basically. But it gets complicated.
No, hold on. Yeah. You're not just kowtowing to every complaint. You are evaluating the complaints and then deciding. Just to make it sound like you're not just saying, businessman X comes in and says, make this easier for me to sell. And you say, okay, tear down this wall.
Well, there's a good question, right? I mean, I think there are legitimate complaints about the trade policy process, but they're not the ones that people might think of first off, right? For example, everything's open and transparent. We publish all of these. I know one of the criticisms of the TPP is that it isn't, but the overall procedure is that we publish, in the National Register, the Federal Register, whatever, we ask for comments. The problem is, of course, who has the time to actually go into there to figure out what's important, what meetings they want to come to and lobby for whatever they want. It ends up being the large corporations. So the rules are tilted to a certain extent to that because they're the ones who can figure out, which rules they want to put in. They put it forward, and then they also have the ability to keep track of things like, well, how much did I spend on this part going into the accord, and I keep the documentation and do all these things, whereas a smaller business says, I'm not going to be bothered to, you know, be able to follow all of the rules. I'm just going to pay the tariff, right, to a certain extent. So the extent that there are these sorts of issues, they arise. But it's hard to get to, I guess, you know, the general more discourse nowadays. We're saying, well, trade negotiations are just bad for the country in general. It's hard to see, again, how that would happen, and I would protest against that. That's what I spend most of my time explaining.
Okay, so listeners, if you've got questions about the process on how some of these deals come together, and again, if it's TPP-related, our guests will do their best to work through at least what we do know, maybe what we don't, or what, as Rob says, what are the real legitimate questions, and then what kind of, when do we lose the forest for the trees here? But you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'd like to listen to some comments that were made on this program just a couple of weeks ago regarding trade deals, trade in general, some of the way that right now in this country, I think in this presidential campaign, trade is being demonized, and then some of the issues surrounding the ostensible secrecy of the TPP. So we'll listen to these comments. They come from Dr. Amit Badabiyal, who is an RIT professor of economics. And at the end of his comments, you're going to hear some of the show music because they came right at the end of the hour that he was on. But we'll listen to his comments, and then we'll come out and talk to our guests about them.
There is no doubt that trade, free trade in particular, has brought advantages to many, many thousands of people all over the world. But the problem is with globalization, or what we call globalization, with any free trade agreement, there are winners and losers. But in this case, the losers have happened to be middle-class American workers. They have been hit hard, particularly those working in the manufacturing sector, and they see no benefits. So the government needs to do a lot more than what it is doing right now to make sure that these people's lives are better affected with training programs and assistance programs of a sort that we simply don't see. Otherwise, you're going to have very little support for free trade agreements. Now, as far as the TPP in particular is concerned, it's hard to pass judgment on it because nobody really knows what it contains. Everything's been secret. You know, all of the people who are passing judgments, they're just passing judgments on little snippets that have, you know, leaked out here and there. Except for President Obama's inner team, we don't know what the contents are.
Yeah, the president says, trust me.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and this one, and that lack of transparency does not build public confidence.
That is right.
Okay, so, Dr. Choi, first of all, on his first set of comments where he said there's no doubt that trade has brought enormous public good, but there are also winners and losers, and that doesn't always get explained very well.
That's right.
What would you say about that?
I would agree with that because at least TPP involved, and then there will be certain losers and winners in the game of international trade. So one of the issues arises from, you know, automobile industry is that which part of rules of origin should be applied to those automakers and auto part producers. The thing is that under NAFTA, then there should be local content requirement, and then there should be 62.5% of products should be procured within NAFTA countries, including United States, Canada, and Mexico. But under TPP, and then their, you know, local content requirement is reduced, just like, you know, 45%. That, you know, from our standpoint, American, you know, automakers and auto part producers can lose their job.
Okay, so when you say, and when he says, Rob, when he says local content requirement, a quick definition or a little background there?
It's I'm not sure how I can explain it more. It is, like you said.
What makes an accord an American car versus...
Right, it's that, you know, the value added has to be, for example, 45%, that all that the parts either were procured within the United States or other NAFTA countries, or else you're adding the value in terms of your finished product is 45% more than what the value of the parts that you put in, right? So this is why I'm saying is that it's actually something that it makes sense, right? Because what I've said before in the past is that, for example, if you just take IKEA furniture and unpack it and unscrew it, and you take it from all other country from all different countries, you can't then say, "Oh, this is now a North American product."
Because we unscrewed it, we put it back together, we quote unquote assembled it here.
Right. Right.
That you can't then say it's American.
Right.
And then gain whatever benefits there are in the trade deal from that. And so what Dr. Cho is saying, you seem to be saying that under TPP, it is a looser requirement for what constitutes a local product. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
That seems to be more easy to exploit for countries.
No.
For companies.
No.
No.
You know, for those producers in the United States, for examples, and then they have to, you know, get the product part from, you know, other than NAFTA countries.
Yep.
As long as 12 different countries involved in TPP, they can get all those product parts from those member countries. Then there will be trade diversion effect. And then that used to be, you know, traded among NAFTA countries, three countries, but then now under TPP, there will be, you know, 12 different countries and all those product parts can be, you know, imported from other than United States, Canada, and Mexico. In that case, that replaces the local producers and products being produced in this country so that there will be a loser in this case. So that loser will be the United States and then we lose our, you know, manufacturing job.
Okay. And if I can try to relate this to a wine industry, because I can do anything, I can relate anything to wine, which I've written about. People may not know that if you pick up a bottle of Finger Lakes wine or pick up a bottle of wine at the liquor store the next time you go, look at the label. There's something called an appellation, which is where it's from. And if it says Finger Lakes on it, by law, and Finger Lakes producers call me if I'm wrong on this, maybe it's changed, it's got to be at least 85% Finger Lakes or more. Finger Lakes sourced, grapes, juice, etc. If it says New York on it, it has to be 75% or more. And if it's American wine, you are drinking probably California or Washington juice. In the New Deal, it's a little bit, to me, from what we're hearing from Dr. Choi, it's like saying, okay, that 85% requirement to get the Finger Lakes label, well, now it's 60%. You know, you can bring in more outside material and still call it local.
That's right.
The same kind of comparison. Okay. And the concern I would have then is, if that's the case, then the Finger Lakes wine industry would be buying more bulk juice from the West Coast and employing less of a local workforce for that. That would be my concern. And is that the same kind of concern in manufacturing industries?
Yes.
If you can bring more of the outside product, you don't have to make it here. You don't have to employ as many people locally.
That's right.
Okay. Rob?
I would object because this is something that you cannot generalize, and this is one of these complexities that that gets difficult to explain. For one thing, it's a matter of I'll give you another concrete example. The European Union, and this is one of the themes in my tweet storm, I suppose, is this idea that do we follow the European rules on these technical non-tariff barriers? That's one of the issues about trade deals. One reason why we do the TPP is because this brings Asian countries under the fold of, you know, the North American system of how we frame these kinds of rules. Under the European scheme, what they normally do is they sign these little bilateral agreements, these preferences, with their former colonies, and they set these really high local content regulations so that, and you know, a country like Togo is expected to, if they want access to the European market, they have to make a finished product that is 85% locally sourced. What does that mean? There's nothing that these countries can export still except for raw materials. It's actually a form of neocolonialism or something like that. There are those kinds of trade deals that are structured that way, but it's not the TPP, if anything. It's for some of these other deals. So it depends a lot on the kind of product and the kind of country that you're trading with. And one of the things also, just one last thing, is that if we think about the most, one of the industries that is the most liberalized, it's information technology, which is covered by one of these early ITAs developed during the 90s and the Uruguay round. We take it for granted. And those in those totally liberalized industries, everybody is involved in free trade. And that's why you have these global supply chains where, again, the iPhone, as everybody's read, you know, parts come from everywhere and it makes, you know, hundreds of stops until it gets to the consumer. And that's what's driven the low, you know, price decreases and rapid innovation. So the idea of, you know, content being a problem, content regulations being a problem and you know, being too relaxed is difficult because some would argue that, you know, this is the way things are going with global supply chains, is that we want to actually get the local content level down to zero. We want to have products being able to go across all borders at all time. Again, that's the ideal, and we're very far from doing it. But the economic theory is that that's what's really going to
keep
costs
down. But people are
scared
of that, Rob.
People are scared.
So before I get to your phone calls, and Jane, we're coming to you in a second because Jane's got a question on policing and accountability, which I think are very important questions. What Rob just mentioned is this maybe even bringing the local content requirement down to zero and really opening the floodgates to international trade. If we've seen anything in this campaign, is that trade is very easily demonized right now as the boogeyman that took your job. And some of what you just said, Robin, I don't want to misinterpret, is that maybe we have to accept in globalization that, you know, there are some shifts in terms of what we should expect when it comes to manufacturing, employment, et cetera. But for those who hear what you say and maybe don't know the issue very well and make it, and they think, well, you don't care about standards for labor, manufacturing, and that this is only going to hurt American jobs because the people who will win are those who don't have any requirements, they don't have labor protections, et cetera. What do you say to that concern, Rob?
It's again, the fundamental difficulty is that it's easy to see the jobs that are lost, but not to see the jobs that are gained. With all of these, the historical experience and the economic theory both lean in one direction. We lose sight of the fact that the economic policy of the original progressive movement of Williams Jennings Bryan was both get rid of the gold standard and get rid of tariffs, right? And now we see, you know, politics, as you say, they're so dangerous now that we're both going back to these these ideas that we thought the progressives had originally already vanquished, that we don't have new ideas. There are these legitimate issues about labor protections and environmental protections, but we need to find creative ways to deal with it. And I think the negotiators of the TPP, for example, have tried to do that rather than to instead have this demonization for these kinds of issues.
Dr. Choi, what do you think?
So, as I mentioned earlier, there will be, you know, definitely winner and loser in the game of international trade. But then, you know, TPP, the ultimate goal of TPP will be, you know, promoting international trade, free trade, as well as fair trade among those member countries. And then there is no one-size-fits-all, you know, trade policies that fitting into all different nations, because all those nations have, you know, different economic situations and their conditions, and even they have, you know, different level of economic development and their policies. So the thing is that, as I mentioned earlier about automakers and automobile industry, to solve this problem definitely takes time. Right. So like 62.5% initially under NAFTA, but under TPP again is, you know, 45%. Definitely that is not good policy to the, you know, American manufacturers.
Rob,
right?
Do you disagree with that? That's not good policy?
I do disagree with that because, again, I think that, for example, you look at the alternative of these freely the most liberalized industries. You can't say that the ITA is bad for Apple. Right. What it's just been good for the technology industry to be as free trading as it is and to develop ways to, again, if we take it for granted that we can hold what we would have considered supercomputers in the 80s and 90s in our pockets. The reason why we can do that is because we created this bubble of really free, idealized free trade for this sector and for this industry.
OK, Dr. Choi, response. Go ahead.
Yes. So according to, you know, economic professor, you know, Paul Krugman, there's a win-win game in international trade. And I agree with that. And in overall, and then there will be, you know, all win-win game for all those countries involved in this, you know, international trade, you know, partnerships at the end of the day. But then specifically for certain industry, it is true that there is winner and loser again. But then overall, if we consider everything, then that will be the good policies to, you know, those countries involved in free trade partnerships.
This is a lot more nuanced than these 30-second ads I've been seeing, by the way, from both of you. That's part of the problem with the discussion of international trade this year. Everybody wants to reduce it to a 30-second ad. Dr. Choi,
so let me add one more thing, yes. Also, as we, you know, signed up for NAFTA in 1994, we didn't remove all tariff barriers immediately. And it, because each country is want to protect their, you know, producers in such as agriculture industries, and then certain, you know, tariff rate, you know, still, you know, in force, such as, you know, corn, you know, high fructose corn syrup and horticultural product. But But then it takes time. And then ultimately in 2008, we all eliminate all those remaining tariffs on those agricultural products. So it takes time. So even if TPP provide, you know, weaker, you know, tariff rate, and then it requires like, you know, lesser, you know, weaker local content requirement, which may hamper to, you know, American producers, but then there will be adjustment.
Okay. Rob, any disagreement there before I go to the phones?
I think we can just go to the phones.
I know. We've got two very interesting perspectives on trade here. And let me start with Gene in Rochester. Go ahead, Gene.
Yes, thanks for putting me on the air. My opinion is that in many ways, the TPP is really not about trade. It's about really about transferring more power than they already have to large international corporations. And just for example, one part of TPP, which has been alluded to but hasn't been really discussed yet, are the international trade tribunals, which will be able to override even the courts of even the United States on almost any issue if a company decided that they weren't making enough profit and brought a lawsuit. For example, if a country wanted to do fracking, say, in the United States or any of the countries, and there was a law against fracking, and it was determined to violate the free trade aspects, it could override the courts. And these tribunals are completely outside of the court systems of any of the countries. They technically violate the sovereignty of all of the countries, and that's one of my main beefs about the TPP.
All right, so Gene, why don't you stay there, and we'll let our panelists weigh in there. Dr. Choi, do you want to start?
Oh yes, as he mentioned, TPP is just, you know, not simply the trade deals among those member countries, but also as far as it involves many different aspects in the field of, you know, international trade. For example, like it also involves and concerns about intellectual property right and, you know, other, you know, internet users and their, you know, internet banning, and then their problems may arise, you know. But then also another example is that TPP covers, you know, more than the NAFTA covers, for example. So it probably brings, you know, bigger pictures, and it is kind of extension of NAFTA in some sense. So like, you know, labor, you know, wildlife trafficking, for example, and also, you know, child labor. And then, you know, those Asian countries other than NAFTA countries have definitely weaker law about that. So as far as it concerns, then it provides a better and, you know, a broad scope of trade policies among those member countries.
Okay, Rob?
Yeah, so this is a great question, right? This is one of the issues about TPP is this ISDS, Investor-State Dispute Settlement. And it's a good example, I think. It's actually, if we can get to a larger question of what I tell my students to think about policy in general, whenever there's something controversial, you want to ask yourself, how does, you know, if something's such a bad idea, how does it come into being? Who benefits from it? With ISDS, this is something that's become controversial in developed countries like the United States. But how it actually got into the trade regime originally, of course, is that it comes from something that American companies wanted. American companies are worried about investing in a country like Vietnam, say, and then having that country just take away their factories, for example, and just expropriate it or something like that. ISDS is supposed to provide safeguards for it. What's interesting, of course, now is that we have these concerns that ISDS is so strong that American governments, either at the state or the federal level, can't put in regulations because, you know, there's this idea that that would be a form of expropriation or something like that. You know, and it's an open question, but it's important to realize that, when people go in to negotiate these provisions, it's actually again, in order to favor American companies, right? That's how it originally comes out with, and we can just debate again whether or not that they do a good job in doing that.
Gene, you want to follow up? Go ahead.
Well, that's assuming that American companies always have the best interest of the American people at heart.
Absolutely. I agree. I mean, that's part of the comments that I said at the beginning, right, is that which American companies also are the ones that are participating in doing the drafting. I absolutely agree with that.
Gene, thank you for the phone call. And a millennial perspective from John, a listener, had emailed the program, and he actually said, right as Gene was calling in, John said, if someone could rationalize ISDS, Investor State Dispute Settlement, I will donate to NPR. I don't know if Rob rationalized it, John, but I guess the rationalization would be, as Rob says, it's the concern about doing business in certain countries where you're worried about needing additional safeguards. Is that correct, Rob?
That's right. I mean, most people would say that it's hard to challenge American laws under ISDS because everybody accepts, and these tribunals accept, that American courts are fair and American laws are fair, and that it's very rare. You know, of course, the critics can point to high-profile cases where there have been some problems. But, you know, again, how much weight we want to put on it is where reasonable people can disagree.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back to Jane's phone call about more on policing of some of these deals. John's email actually had some other things that I want to get to when it comes to the allegations of secrecy, or at least are, who is allowed to participate in constructing some of these deals and agreements. So I kind of suspected this would happen. We didn't expect to spend the entire hour just on TPP, but, you know, I understand it's in the news. We're talking trade, though, and in general, how these agreements come together, how they're constructed, what they mean, and how they're sort of policed and renewed. As Rob Shum said earlier, it's not just a one-time deal where a trade deal is constructed and then you walk away and it's done. You revisit, sometimes you rework. There are questions on who is involved with making sure mechanisms are being enforced, etc. Rob's a professor of political science and international studies at the SUNY College at Brockport. He also was a Canadian representative on the NAFTA Committee on Trade in Goods. And Dr. Jung Ho Choi is here, an assistant professor in the School of Business at St. John Fisher College. More of your comments and questions next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, the summer of food continues with a discussion about corporate takeovers. We're looking at beer in particular. If craft beer gets bought up by the big conglomerates, does that make that brand a sellout? And should you drink that beer, or should you abandon it? Or is it more complicated than that? We'll talk about beer making, quality, survival, and more Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Jane in Rochester. Next up, go ahead, Jane.
Yes, a lot of us feel like that these trade deals are put together by elitist for elitist, and they are insulated from any kind of consequence when it all falls apart. And if you remember, Greenspan talked about how there was a flaw in his thinking about the infallibility of the market economy. Okay, but all of us out here, we have to deal with the consequences. And so they do all their hocus pocus and their lives just go on like they were. But I wonder, one thing that really irritates me, when Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, when they speak, it is with such clarity. When you get an economist on, Evan, they drown thinking in an avalanche of words. And it's been said by some that the truth is sometimes relatively simple, but if you want to lie, you better make it convoluted and complicated so that us little people out here really won't get it. But I resent also the fact that the labor is not at the table, and that the citizenry, whatever happens, we will pay. And the people that design these great theories, they walk away free. There's no problem with them. So I don't trust, and it does come down to their saying to us, just trust us.
Well,
thank you.
Jane, thanks for the phone call. So a couple of points. I know Sweet Jane is not at all alleging that our guests in studio are obfuscating for any nefarious purposes. I know that. But I also know that Jane is making a point that we hear often, which is that when things get overly complex, They are often designed to obfuscate. It feels that way with trade deals. Jane brings up Elizabeth Warren. John, our emailer, had referred to Elizabeth Warren being quoted in the Boston Globe as follows. So let me read what Elizabeth Warren said, and Rob and Jung Ho can tell us if this is overly simplifying the issue or if this is a fair complaint. Warren said, quote, as quoted by the Boston Globe, quote, "The text of the TPP has been classified and the public isn't permitted to see it, but 28 trade advisory committees have been intimately involved in the negotiations. Of the 566 committee members, 480, or 85%, are senior corporate executives or representatives from industry lobbying groups. Many of the advisory committees are made up entirely of industry representatives," end quote. And of course, the implication is they're creating a deal, as Jane said, elite protecting the elite. Rob, is that oversimplified, or is that a legitimate concern that the public should have?
I think what's fascinating is that actually it is the complex argument that's being lost, that when we talk about trade economics, from across the political spectrum, and this is one of the strange things about economists that Jane is disparaging, though, is that there is a consensus that how, in theory, trade is supposed to work is that it generates gains for society as a whole, but particular sectors will lose. And what the policies that should be done for it is to liberalize trade, but then to redistribute the gains from trade to the losing sectors. There's nobody that this is not controversial. But in the real world, of course, trade gets parceled aside on one side, and we have the liberalization, but then we don't have the redistribution, which economists, again, across the spectrum, often say that, well, there needs to be more done to help retrain workers in industries that lose jobs, and that there should be compensation, and that there's enough surplus generated from the gains from trade for that to happen. But it's become politically unpopular, ideologically unpopular.
Yeah, Jane, the point Rob just made is exactly what Amit Badabial from RIT made on this program in recent weeks, which is that that number one, we oversimplify trade and demonize it. That, as Rob said earlier, it's easy to point to the jobs lost. It's less clear to point to the benefits and the gains of trade, but they are there and they are many. And that when there are tangible losses, and there are, largely in manufacturing in this country, that we can do more to soften the blow for those workers and to help them, particularly, as Rob says, with the surpluses of trade or some of the gains from trade. And maybe that should be more of the public conversation about what to do. Rob, what do you think?
I think that's fair.
Fair enough? Yeah. Okay, Dr. Choi, what do you think? I mean, you've got Jane saying it doesn't feel like she can trust this, that it's not transparent. She's pointing to Elizabeth Warren, who says this is cooked up by big industry people. Does that oversimplify it in your
opinion? Yeah, but it is, very, politically and, very sensitive issues. So I can't really judge which should we, go or take.
Do you feel it's transparent? Is it easy to understand the process for the public, or is it not transparent enough?
Not transparent enough, because, some of the process of TPP is confidential, and then no one knows really about, because when they, for example, calculate the, tariff rate, or how much they reduce or cut their tariff rate or local content requirement again, unless they know exactly the companies, their sales values and net cost. Other than that, we cannot really exactly, precisely calculate, those, rate.
Mm-hmm. Rob?
Yeah, I can address this transparency issue to a certain extent. I think one of the things, and there should be a debate about what the appropriate policy process is for negotiating trade policies and trade deals. But I think one of the reasons, again, if we go back to why we have the system that we have, why we have fast-track authority for the executive branch, why there's this idea that why do we make the policy in the context of international negotiations, which necessarily involve a certain amount of confidentiality when you're trading with other countries? It's like, same with nuclear arms deals. You wouldn't expect it to be done in the open air. And we can question that, but the background to it is, of course, that in the past, when we left the legislature to deal with trade policy, you get complete vulnerability to special interests lobbying for protection for each particular product and industry. That's, again, what William Jennings Bryan was railing against. That's what happened with Smoot-Hawley in the Great Depression, which made it worse. And so actually, the politicians got together and said, okay, let's change the system. Let's pass a law giving this authority to the executive branch so that they don't have to do it in the open air and being vulnerable to every single lobbyist. Have we gone too far? That's a question we need to have, but it's important to be aware of why we're here.
Right? All right, Senator Shum, the committee wants to know if you think we've gone too far in that direction then.
I think we can adapt to technology to a certain extent. You know, in a way, we're already doing it, right? Because you already see the leaks that come out. People are already, you know, NGOs are already posting versions of it. And you know, of course, people who are in the system really think that this is the end of the world and there are disadvantages to it, but maybe this is the way that things are going and we can't even stop it anymore.
Let me go ahead and try to close the loop on a couple of themes that listeners have brought up via email. So first of all, John, who was the millennial listener who, and self-described millennial, just wanted to offer a millennial perspective, he said, but he raised the question on ISDS and he joked that he would donate to NPR if he could get a good rationalization for ISDS. I don't think Rob Shum from the College of Brockport was taking up for or against ISDS. I think what he was saying is when ISDS gets justified, here's why. Here's the framework for why it was created and why it could benefit. John writes and says, ISDS, is, he follows up to say, ISDS has been used to sue small countries that try to pass laws that hurt profits of the large corporations, tobacco companies, etc. Corporations do not have our well-being in their thoughts. Donation withheld for now. Okay, John. Rob Shum, again, I don't know if you're arguing for or against ISDS, but is he correct to say it's been used to sue small countries that try to pass laws that hurt profits of corporations?
I think there is merit to that argument. What's interesting is that you normally have the arguments, right? That one of the problems with trade policy discussions is the demonization goes the other way, right? The idea is that we're losing these deals. But the criticism that actually it's the small countries that are losing, right? It's the ones that the United States has so much bargaining power. We have the largest market, and we force these countries to accept our rules. That has a lot more merit. That's especially in intellectual property area, which Professor Choi has brought up to a certain extent, right? These are rules where we go into Vietnam and say, you can't make generic drugs anymore. You have to buy from our large pharmaceuticals at whatever prices they set to protect their intellectual property rights. Right. When you have examples like that, the listener comment would seem to reinforce, it's get reinforced by that.
OK. A couple other listener emails. Steve writes to the program and said, Evan, I understood the point about creating a Honda Accord in Ohio. And the question is, when does it become an American product? But can you clearly explain what the benefit to a company would be to be able to claim made in the USA for trade purposes? Rob?
It means that they can, for example, they can send the car to Canada or Mexico without paying an additional tariff or an additional tax. Whereas a Japanese car, assembled in Japan, going into Canada or Mexico actually has to pay another 2.5%, 6%, 11%, depending on, you know, what it is, a car or a truck or whatever category it falls under.
Okay. Alex wants to know how often these trade deals get reviewed and policed. I'll start with Rob, who's kind of worked on... Why don't you explain again for the listeners who may have missed some of the work background, a short explanation on some of the work you did, and then you can answer Alex's question.
Well, there's this ongoing work about amending, you know, these technical rules of like content regulations and various things. Things get even more detailed that you can't even imagine, you know, in terms
yes.
of I can't even remember some of these things. They're so boring. And
by the way,
and
Rob's going back to NAFTA, not TPP, to state the obvious.
Right.
But go ahead.
And so there's this revisit. I'm not sure what you mean by policing. That's in a way one way to look at what ISDS is, that it's a way of actually providing mechanisms so that when that there are these tribunals that can determine the interpret the rules. So that's, again, that's everything ties together with that. But in terms of an amending process, because obviously with any law there should be, and a lot, we know a lot of laws don't have this, but there should be this review process to make sure that everything still makes sense as we learn more and as time goes on.
All right, a question for both panelists comes from Dan, and I'll read Dan's email. He says, it seems there's a sketchy dichotomy set up between isolationist economic suicide and globalized integrated economic success. What do your panelists think of this dichotomy? NAFTA, TPP, TTIP, etc. are held up as paths toward globalized economic success, but people-oriented analysis of these trade pacts tend to reach a similar conclusion, that they represent and perpetuate a race to the bottom. If we assume preference of globalization to isolation, why can't the big money consumer markets like US and the EU declare high standards, and in doing so, influence the producers who want access to those markets? And for example, the idea of a living wage, the actual figures vary widely depending on where the work is being done, but the metric applies broadly. If you want to source labor in China or Bangladesh or anywhere, prove your workers are paid a living wage or face tariffs for your goods and potential ostracization from those markets. So-called trade deals seem to take the wrong approach, at least in part because of the elite interests involved and the interests of the masses of the people are shut out. That's from Dan. Professor Choi, you want to start? Go ahead. What do you think of that?
Yes. So let me give you an example. So Apple's, they have a factory in, actually they outsource their manufacturing and assembly activities to Foxconn in China. And then their, Apple's products are being produced in China. But then the thing is that a couple of years ago, the problem lies in China's factory is, they use, children laborers with under 16 year old, right? Then do you believe it is Apple's problems or it is Foxconn's problems? For those manufacturers, involved in outsourcing, in producing their product part or assembling activities, then those producers outside of the United States, they have to follow the rules and regulations that we have, as a, possibly strongest, policies that we provide in public. So we also, Apple has, responsibility to take care of their, suppliers and their manufacturing activities and their process. So in this case, so TPP, for example, as long as it involves all those kind of issues that at the end of the day, it provides a good, rules and regulations for not only for those, producers in Asian countries, but also the United States.
Rob Shum.
I don't know which direction I should take this question. I could go into this whole question of this, again, demonization of certain practices in foreign countries. We had that whole thing with This American Life, and then
I believe it was the iPhone of China.
That's right. But then another NPR program, Adam Minter on Planet Money, I think debunked all of these claims about child labor in Foxconn factories, that this sort of thing didn't happen. There's no coerced labor or anything like that. I don't even want to get into that.
But you're not saying, are you, that labor in all parts of Asia, as an example, is equal to the standards that we have in this country, are you?
It's not. But on the other hand, there's this question of, again, in economic theory, the idea is that wages naturally reflect productivity. The fact that wages are low in low-wage countries is because people aren't productive. They don't have education. They're not working on the most advanced technology. And this is just reflected. If they become more productive, then the companies are going to have to pay them more because they're going to start leaving the factories. And we're seeing that in China, where they're actually having a labor crunch now, and the labor supply is shrinking as the population gets older. What I do want is, again, I would encourage people, when you think about these questions, though, is to really look at the details, unfortunately, right? And I know it's complicating. If you are concerned about competition with China, then TPP is designed to deal with that, right? It's designed to move activity away from China, right? China's not part of the TPP. It's the idea is that instead, we're creating an incentive. We're creating a little club or group for our allies to trade with us instead, so that we move the shoe factories out of China and to Vietnam instead, because they're willing to play by our rules. So if you want the rules, to set those higher standards, as the caller is saying, and to do the rules, that's what these trade deals are about.
Could these trade deals bring about an increase in wages and standards of living?
This is a knotty, difficult question, right? I mean, this is the thing, is that how do we do that? And we do need creative ideas to deal with that, right? Advocates of the deal will say that there are, that this is a new kind of deal that that really does try to put teeth into that, and other people are going to say it's not enough. And, you know, again, this is more boring, complex stuff to look at. You know, how far do you want to go down this road?
You got
to
stop calling this boring. You can't come on the show and say that something you're talking about is boring, because it's important. And part of what Jane and people like Elizabeth Warren say is, you know, if we all treat it like it's boring, then we're not in the game. But, you know, I know Rob's mostly kidding. But it's complex. It's dense. It's not always easily simplified. But that doesn't mean that it is definitionally nefarious, then, by the way. Milt in Penfield. Go ahead, Milt.
I just wanted to add something quickly to your current discussion. I could easily bounce back to 1984 and saying that you're talking about 1984. I'm talking about the 22nd century. The fact is that the competition that you're not talking about is the competition for global warming. Because if China is allowed, if any country on Earth is allowed to offset the ionosphere over that country, it affects every other country. China today is killing us, and we're killing somebody else downstream, and we're trying to avoid talking about all that carbon that we're putting up in the air, and how many people, all those pollutants that we're putting out because we manufacture so well plastic. We're doing all of that to kill people in the future, and we're not talking about the future. The future must come down to your gentleman's talking about how does a United Nations of the environment control the pollution that's spilled out by Ohio or by China or by Southeast Asia. No matter what anybody says, and no matter how many people talk about, we'll trade our carbon coupons. That's it. I'll listen in.
No, Milt, thank you for that. And I think before I ask our panelists to weigh in, I would say that NAFTA was negotiated at a very different time in understanding and conversation about climate change. Now, I think what Milt raises is an important question. When we talk about developing world economies and industries around the world, how often are we bringing in climate change to something like a trade deal? Is that happening at all? What do we know about that? Professor Choi, is there any knowledge that evaluating climate change happens when constructing something like a TPP? Do you think, Dr. Choi, any idea?
There's another issues behind, you know, international trade. So, for example, like foreign direct investment. And then besides the international trade, you know, a lot of multinational corporations, they enter into the United States and then they build a factory, right? Just like automakers, for examples. And then they, you know, not only build their, you know, factories in the United States, but also they hire their people, local peoples in the United States. But also their carbon dioxide emission has been increased in these countries. When it comes to, you know, international trade and its global competitions, that we probably, you know, some part we lose in the game of international trade, but as long as we receive, you know, a lot of multinational corporations in this country for their research and development activities, and other than that, such as like technology development and licensing activities, then that also provides, you know, benefit to our country.
Okay, Rob?
Yeah, I think this is a good question to end with, right? It's a question of, we've been discussing trade policy in a sort of narrow economic context, but it's hard not to bring in all of these other larger issues. I think one of the things, about the TPP is that that's difficult to talk about is that a lot of the, you know, rationale for it isn't really about trade and jobs and the economy. It's actually about the larger geopolitical implications of keeping our alliances in Asia intact, about excluding China, as I've alluded to before, you know, and about, you know, who sets the rules for the economic game in the 22nd century. Is it the United States? Is it Europe? Or is it China? We have this opportunity, but it seems like we're having all these reservations about it again. About the narrow question about the tying with climate, that's obviously another big topic for the next century. There's talk about having green goods, green economy goods, sustainable technologies be put into something similar to what I mentioned earlier about information technology, to have those kinds of technologies be freely traded and to promote technological innovation and trade in that area. So there's work in that area, definitely.
Okay, moving to the end of the program, almost out of time. Henry wants to know, what would it take for Professor Shum to personally oppose a trade deal? I'm sure that you could see yourself opposing a deal.
Yeah, if the data comes in and shows that it's something that makes things worse, right? I mean, I think with a lot of these deals, like, for example, like I don't want to beat up my European colleagues, but it seems like sometimes you can structure a deal in a way that really is mercantilist to a certain extent, right? That makes it, that's really designed to have trade only occur in certain industries, certain very powerful industries, but they're not usually the industries that you think of, right? It's normally things like agriculture, and things like that. There are certain, situations that definitely arise.
Okay, and Herman emails the program to push back on Jane's point a little bit. Jane earlier had said that that when you hear a lot of complexity, it's generally designed to confuse and obfuscate, and often a simple explanation is required to cut through it. Herman says, I'd like to point out that the ideologues and demagogues tend to paint simplistic pictures of complex issues in order to push their agendas or mislead voters as well. They whip up outrage by pointing the finger of blame at one policy for our problems, banking on the fact that many will believe them without delving more deeply into a complex matter and applying critical thinking. So a little pushback there. I think this is as complex as it gets, understanding trade deals, and that's why I wanted Rob Shum and Professor Jung Ho Choi to come in and help us understand. Not that we have solved TPP, it wasn't all about TPP, but I want to thank them for being here. Rob, I hope I proved you wrong. You saw the interest in this.
When you're lost in the trees, you can't see it, but it sounds like it. Thanks, Evan.
There's a tremendous amount of interest in it. Your expertise is welcome anytime. I hope you'll come back. Thank you. That's Rob Shum from the SUNY College at Brockport. He's a professor of political science and international studies. And Jung Ho Choi is an assistant professor in the School of Business at St. John Fisher College. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me here.
And Rob Braden, our engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and we will talk with you Thursday on member-supported public radio.